Good morning. I am sitting in for Representative/Fire Chief Matthews this morning. He sends his regards but wasn't able to make it today. So I open this hearing on the House Interim Committee on Veteran Services and Emergency Preparedness. And we're going to just try and get moving right along. So first of all, happy Memorial Day week to everyone. And let's start off with an informational meeting. So do I go? With an update on the World War II Memorial with Jim Willis and anyone else who's here to present on that. Good morning. Please state your name for the record. And
my name is Jim Willis, private citizen, and I live in Albany, Oregon. So, Chair Fagan and members of the committee, I am here today to give you an update on the Oregon's World War II Memorial. I currently serve as the vice president of the Oregon World War II Memorial Foundation. And it was our responsibility to take on this project and to see it through to the end. Just 2 years ago, June 6th of 2012, we did the groundbreaking right here at the intersection of Court Street and Cottage. And we were soliciting donations to build the memorial. And the Oregon State Legislature played a large part in that by allocating $250,000 to the effort. This is a approximately $1.2 million project. So in that two-year period, it was our responsibility to raise these funds to build the memorial in an economy that did not lend itself very well to that kind of fundraising. But because of what it is and what it was for, we were successful, I'm happy to tell you. In fact, we should be able to pay all of our bills and transfer the memorial to the people of the state of Oregon a week from tomorrow, on June the 6th. So the dedication ceremony is at 1:30 p.m. on Friday, June the 6th, here on the grounds of the state capitol. And I will tell you that while it is a war memorial, it was not built to glorify war. Rather, it was built to honor the sacrifice and service of an entire generation of Americans who basically saved the world at a time when fascism, Nazism, and Japanese imperialism was threatening the globe. Over 16 million Americans served in uniform during that time, and millions more on the home front in shipyards and growing the food and building the aircraft and so on that allowed us to win the war. On the memorial itself are the names of 3,772 Oregonians who lost their lives in World War II, and 160,000 Oregonians served in uniform. And again, many more served in industry here in Oregon, like the shipyards up around Portland and in the Mid-Valley where they grew the food, and the Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts that went out and did the scrap drives. And of course, let's not forget the women who gave up their nylons. So everybody sacrificed. But more importantly, in World War II, everybody was in it. Everybody was committed to getting this thing done and suffered through rationing and the sharing of things among one another to make sure that we could continue to live as free Americans. The other thing I'd like to point out to you about what we call the greatest generation is an interesting concept that maybe some people don't think about. And it is that if you were in Germany or Italy or Japan and decided to attack this country, you probably should have understood what that generation had just gone through, which was the Great Depression. So they had already sacrificed. They had already had a very hard time just living day to day because of the Great Depression. And they were just coming out of the Great Depression at the time our country was attacked. So here they were looking at a brighter future, and here were other people threatening that future. That was a grave mistake on the part of the enemies of this nation. So this tough generation of men and women went over and took care of business, basically. And I want to say something about the women of World War II. You know, we hear a lot about Rosie the Riveter. What we don't hear about is Wanda the Welder and Polly the Painter and Carrie the Carpenter and so on. There were huge change in the role of women in our society as a result of World War II. So having worked in the munition plants and the aircraft plants and the shipyards and learning all these different trades, it was quite interesting, if you study history, to see then when the war is over and the, quote, men came home and told this generation of American women, here's the apron, get back in the kitchen. Well, they weren't quite ready to do that. And it changed forever the role of women in our society. And because nearly half of that 16 million took advantage of the GI Bill and received at least a baccalaureate education, it changed the class that, and it created an entire class in our nation, which we now call the middle class. And that was all as a result of how we took care of these folks when they got home. So let me close by answering the question that I probably get asked the most, and that is, why did it take so long to build a memorial? Oregon being one of only six states in the nation that did not have a World War II memorial. Well, I might ask also, why did it take until 2006 to create the National World War II Memorial on the Mall in Washington, D.C.? As the son of a combat infantryman who served in World War II, I think I can answer a little bit of that. These folks were called to serve. And as some of them have told me, we went because there was no one else. It was our duty and our job. And so when we came home, we wanted to start our families. We wanted to go to school. We wanted to start a business. We wanted to build a home. And the last thing on our mind was a memorial. We wanted to get on with our lives and recapture the 3, 4, or 5 years we had just lost. And that's what that generation did. And so as a result, they raised the next generation, who had it far better, of course, than they did, but they were somewhat less patient with some of us younger people who seemed to not understand the value of hard work and the ability to save and sacrifice. But I think they taught us well enough to where we were able to go when we were called and do our duty. So this Friday, June the 6th, the 70th anniversary of the D-Day invasion, will be, I believe, the last major gathering of World War II veterans in our state, simply because of their age. Yeah. If you were 20 at the D-Day invasion, you are 90 now. And so we will see a lot of 90-year-olds this next 2 weeks from Friday, or a week from Friday. And I think that these folks, for lack of a better term, both those who served overseas and those who served on the home front, I think they are a national treasure. And I think to the extent that every Oregonian can come to that ceremony, they should. And if they want to help a lot, if they know a World War II veteran, put them in the car, bring them down, help them get to a seat, have them see their ceremony, and they will see a piece of Oregon history unfold before their very eyes. So, Chair Fagan, members of the committee, that concludes my update on the World War II Memorial, and I appreciate your time this morning. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, and I was jotting down a couple of names of folks that I know who are World War veterans that I'll have to make sure to let them know, and I appreciate you mentioning Wanda the Welder, because in our family it was Imogene the Welder, but my grandma Fagan was a welder at the Portland shipyards during World War II, and we have a cool picture of her aboard a ship called the Imogene Fagan, because she was the first to weld the ship perfectly. So they ended up naming the ship after her. Oh. So it was ship 939 on the Portland shipyards, and it was the Imogene Fagan, and she's in overalls, and we got a cool black and white picture of her on that. So thank you for mentioning the women as well as the men who did their service. So any questions or comments from the panel? Thank you. Great. Well, thank you for all your wonderful work, sure. And we will wish for a great turnout for you on June 6th.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
So next, we will hear an update on the Association of Counties Veterans Committee and the Multnomah County Veterans Services Task Force. So I'll invite John Lindsay, Joseph Riley, and Cameron Smith to join us. In whatever order you prefer.
Can they hear okay? Okay. Good morning. My name is John Lindsay. I'm a Linn County Commissioner. I'm also a member of the newly formed Association of Oregon Counties Veterans Affairs Committee. I'm here to report on behalf of the counties that we appreciate the partnership that we have with our ODVA partners and the legislature, and that partnership is good and strong at the moment. I'm also here to, again, thank this committee for their effort to ensure us the extra $1 million appropriation for veteran service officers in our counties that you had done in the past legislative session. I wanted to take a moment to relay a bit of an example of why these CVSOs are so important to veterans within our jurisdictions. Several years ago, I was approached by an individual whose husband had undergone cancer operations at the Veterans Affairs Hospital. And what the problem was that the cancer operation is one procedure, but chemotherapy is a different procedure. So he's denied on procedure number two, but he can have all the surgeries he wants. So he had five cancer surgeries, but never had the follow-up to get rid of the cancer. So I called our service officer and told her to go to work on that. And through working together throughout the state with these CVSOs, we found out there were four individuals that did not know that, guess what, they're from the same unit in Vietnam. They were the same ones that were soaked repeatedly in Agent Orange. They were the same ones that had this extremely rare cancer. One of those four individuals was entitled to chemotherapy and his cancer was cured. What we did through that effort was put these CVSOs in contact, and guess what? We could put together a program that under the next surgery, these individuals got the paperwork done to receive that chemotherapy treatment. If they had not received it, I can sit here and tell you today, right now, those three other individuals would not be alive today if that was not done. And that was the CVSOs that advocate for the veteran on an individual level in the county in which they are. I'm extremely thankful to you guys for the support that you have given us over the years. I hope that we can continue this relationship, and it's so important to the counties. That's why we started to form a Veterans Services Committee and made it a loan committee so that those of us that are interested in these issues can continue to work together with the director of the ODVA and work together with other individuals throughout the state and coalesce as a single unit, so that we're not operating on an individual level. So I look forward to more of this in the future. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good morning and thank you for this opportunity. My name is Joseph Riley. I'm the Lane County Veterans Service Officer and past president of the Oregon County Veterans Service Officer Association. At the heart, County veteran service officers are advocates for veterans and family members, often surviving spouses, who are seeking benefits from the VA. So that's our overall mission. Day-to-day, though, we act as attorneys for the veterans in the claims process, or the equivalent of attorneys, mental health therapists, social workers, case managers, and translators. Even when they receive letters from the VA, we translate their language into English. And so we're working with these veterans and their families for three main benefits, typically: accessing VA health care, applying for service-connected compensation for current health issues that are directly related to their military service, and what's called non-service-connected pension, a needs-based safety net for veterans who served in a wartime era. That benefit often comes into play for older veterans who need long-term care. Medical need and medical expenses are two of the driving factors in this benefit. And so we're helping right now a lot of Korean-era veterans, World War II-era veterans, and their surviving spouses obtain these benefits. In the you know, technically veterans or claimants in the VA process don't need an advocate in the process, but related to if you have a business, if you own rentals or something, and you're trying to file your income taxes, sure, you could probably figure it out, go through the process, do okay. But if you work with a qualified tax preparer or an accountant, you're going to ensure that you do it properly and you obtain the greatest refund that you might be entitled to. And so that's our role, is to make sure that the VA is processing the claim properly, to make sure that veteran or the claimant has all the evidence they need so the VA makes the proper decision, and then to review that decision with the veteran, their surviving spouse, to make sure that the VA got it right. If they didn't get it right, we can help them get the evidence that the VA thinks is lacking, ask for a reconsideration, or go into the appeals process. So, I'm very proud to sit here on this panel. It's only with the support of the state, with our local elected officials, and the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs that the county veteran service officers are able to do their work. So, thank you to all of you and to everyone here. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Fagan, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Cameron Smith, the director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and I did not pay these two gentlemen for such good compliments and words of our team at the state level. I don't think I would be in this position if we did not preach the gospel of partnerships. When we go back to D.C. with our National Association of State Veterans Affairs Directors, the feds also preach that same gospel. But what is happening in Oregon right now, both at that local, regional, and state level, truly is beginning to walk the walk of that talk. This morning from 9 to noon at the Convention Center, we'll be having a number of the CVSOs rally and also the local providers or service providers from the local level in a veteran summit co-sponsored with the National Guard. We have been proud. It feels like I think it's every 2 weeks. How often is the AOC? Every 4 weeks, meeting with the AOC subcommittee or the Committee on Veterans Services, and just like the legislature has called it out on both the House and the Senate side, as an individual committee, just in the last year, now AOC has called it from out from under the human services side so that it gets the attention and visibility of the county commissioners. And now a voluntary assessment at the local level where counties can chip in, and now helping to staff Andy Smith to be that full-time staffer for that committee is a huge boon for our work. Just yesterday, we presented to the emergency board for the first time in a long time from ODVA's level, and looking at both on our policy option packages and on the e-board submission, one of our top priorities is on that training of our county VSOs. They are that regional network, the boots on the ground that help the veterans and their families navigate what is a challenging benefit system and access to the health care at the federal level. Both Representative Esquivel and Representative Huffman can attest. It is not an easy process to go through. And to have that kind of advocacy and support throughout is essential. So right now we have Mitch Sparks is our one-man team training the 55 county VSOs, and the submission yesterday would double that capacity for the rest of this biennium if approved by the full e-board tomorrow. And then for our top priority for our policy option package going forward is to continue that robust training function and have at least two full-time staff as resources for the counties. Beyond that claims, that formal power of attorney, we also ask our county VSOs to be that hub of the wheel and center of gravity in their community, linking to homeless resources outside of that veteran services lane, linking to the homeless resources, the employment resources, whether they're state agencies, nonprofits, faith-based, community college. They go above and beyond the 9-to-5 job to be that critical link in the community. Beyond the work that that does for our veterans and their families, I just want to call out what all of you know is that significant economic impact of all these federal VA dollars flowing down. Finally, the 2013 data is out. $1.1 billion of cold hard cash flowing back into the wallets and bank accounts of our veterans. That's up $200 million from the 2012 numbers, and a total impact of $2.2 billion when you wrap in all the GI Bill and the health care benefits. But $1.1 billion is just on the disability compensation and payments. Somewhat incomprehensible, but that's $92 million every month flowing into the Oregon economy. And for your districts, down in Jackson County with some 20,000 veterans, for Representative Esquivel, $88 million. In Clackamas, $80 million plus. Columbia and Tillamook on the coast, $16.7 million and $11.6 million in disability compensation and low-income pension payments. Wasco County re-engaged with a powerful volunteer model, where we also were you able to join us out there in Wasco County? I don't think you
were. No, I was not.
So we took a bunch of the county commissioners and the AOC staff and our state-level folks out to Wasco County to see their volunteer model. They've taken over the old Greyhound bus station downtown, just a center of gravity there with a huge volunteer network beyond the county BSOs, $7.6 million. And then in Clatsop County, $12.5 million flowing in. Pretty powerful, both in those urban areas where most of our veterans live, but then in those rural areas where they make up some 25 to a third of the population. Just a significant economic driver, both for the individual veterans and their families, and then our economy at large. We know, given the size, 320,000 veterans, four generations across five major wars, the diversity of the issues we face, it will not be because of ODVA's 80 full-time staff that we make a difference in the lives of our veterans. It will solely be, we think our biggest leverage is with those county VSOs, both augmenting them to be able to do that two-pronged mission and then making sure they are well-staffed and well-resourced. So happy to take any questions.
Yes, Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A few things. one is I have shared my frustration over the years on the record in this committee with the lengthy appeal that I had been going through. And I'm happy to report, and I really appreciate Mitch Sparks, and he's kind of my personal BSO. I don't know why he keeps me and doesn't flip me off to somebody else, but in April, after 5 years of appeal, finally got the positive outcome. So I wanted to share that since I, you know, shared the other part about my angst over all of it and frustration for taking so long. Cameron, and thank all of you and Andy for all the work that you're doing by forming the committee and meeting every 4 weeks. And I want to encourage you, Cameron, when it comes budgeting time, as you're doing with the e-board, because EBA used to be one of my budgets when I was co-chair of the subcommittee, and so I'm pretty familiar with the budget. But I want to encourage you to not be bashful when it comes 15-17 budgeting time for the County Veterans Service Officer line item. Over the years, there were tendencies to cut it back, to shift a little money to other funds that were, you know, emergency funds, great and necessary funds. But I just want to encourage you to really step up to the plate there and do it all, and I will support you in the ask that's really needed to support the counties in their efforts. And then a question. Is there a effort, because of the changes that we're seeing with the federal VA, is there any formal effort, because we've talked about it for years, to try to get some local care for veterans to shift from, because, you know, the headlines have been the last several weeks that cancer patients couldn't get in to get their chemotherapy, and they died while they were waiting to get their appointment at the VA hospital. Is there a formal effort to try to get the feds to change the model to where I could get chemotherapy in the Dalles at Mid-Columbia Medical Center? If there's a certain period of time that I need care and I can't get it through the VA system, that I would have the option to be able to go to my local provider.
So, Chair Fagan, Representative Huffman, obviously a lot of attention right now on the federal VA, on both on the disability claims backlog and then on the medical center and the healthcare side. There has always been that tension between providing that healthcare
within the VA's largest integrated healthcare system, over 150 medical centers across the country. We have Portland VA Medical Center, Roseburg. We feed veterans from the Gorge into Walla Walla, and Eastern Oregon often feeds into Boise's VA Medical Center. There has always been that tension between care in the system and that care in the community. What we haven't seen necessarily duplicate lists and kind of corrupt practices, there is no doubt that access to health care for our veterans has continued and has been and will continue to be a challenge. Whether that access is simply wait lists to get the appointments, or for being a large rural state, transportation to those large medical centers with a robust DAV van network, but often volunteer drivers that are aging out and not the younger generation necessarily stepping up yet. Transportation is an access issue for our rural veterans to that healthcare system. And then separately and lastly, the not every veteran is eligible for that VA healthcare. So access is a challenge. And I'll send the committee staff some recent talking points that have come out of the most recent crisis. About 8.9% of the federal VA's healthcare budget is for that in-community care, a fee basis where you could get, whether it's a local cancer center or a local mental health provider. And that's a 75% increase, I think, over the last 5 to 6 years. So the trend has been moving more, but it's still the way they get the most bang for those $900 million is within that system. And the system is beloved by our veterans once they get that access. It is unbelievable and excellent care. Both Director Willis's predecessor and my predecessor, John Mangus, receiving excellent care currently at the VA Medical Center up in Portland. It is a beloved institution, but access remains a challenge. And I think we will continue to see, as we lose population demographically, it's going to be tough to maintain the robust network of clinics that we've pushed out to the local level and the large medical centers in rural areas. And I think we will see more and more of a focus on that in-community care. And that's, I think it's a positive boon as we link to coordinated care organizations, as it supports. Those would be dollars flowing into the local healthcare system that sometimes already have a challenge recruiting providers, whether on the mental health side or nurses and doctors. So I think it's going to be a positive conversation, but will be over the next 20 years that I think we will begin to see that more larger shift to more in-community care. But it's beginning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Cameron, just to follow up on that, too, is don't forget, and you did mention it, that the drivers of the vans are getting older and older and fewer, and some counties only have one van, and what if it breaks down? But something that we've experienced in Clatsop, and I'm sure Tillamook, too, but since I live in Clatsop, I hear about it more, but I have a lot of these guys in my neighborhood, actually. And I'm only 12 miles out of town, but sometimes we're cut off either by a storm, trees down, ice on the roads. And when it's icy or even thinking of snowing, some of the drivers don't want to go over. So it would be great if they could just easily go to the local clinics where they can get care immediately.
May I address this just a moment? Is that a lot of us, when we look at these things from a county perspective, there are certain counties that can do certain things and certain ones that can't do other things. In Linn County, you're aware that we went back to the voters to make sure that we had a veterans home and asked the voters for $15 million. They did it. We've had an open discussion about the fact that you have what's called VA clinics and VA outpatient centers, and we have made the suggestion in writing to the VA that if real estate is a problem, Linn County will produce it. What we need is someone to operate it, and we need someone to do that. That's kind of how we did the veterans home. These are an extremely high priority for us. To give you an example of statistics here, 1 in 5 adults inside Linn County is a veteran. So, and I know that Representative Esquivel, the estimates for your county where you live are much greater, and it really surprises people when you come out with that. And there are many of us that are willing to put forward and do that effort. These are an important part of our community, and it's as former ODVA director Jim Willis used to say, the greatest economic driver in the United States historically is a veterans population, whether it be through education, whether it be through retirements, whether it be the whole myriad of whatever your financial aspects are. Not to toot his horn, but he does know that.
Representative Parrish.
Tell me about, I mean, I appreciate that Representative Huffman got his stuff resolved after 5 long years. We're 27 months into that at our house, and still no end in sight of dealing with the VA to get processed for my husband. I can't imagine, though, being in a situation where, and I got a lot of weird feedback up here, but I can't imagine being in a situation where if, you know, if Mark was in a place where we needed the benefit or we needed the health care access immediately, and you're waiting in that average of 39 months or, you know, I think for a lot of people it's longer depending on what service era that they are. That doesn't stop somebody from having a tooth problem today or a health care, you know, crisis today, and they're not getting services that they need. So what are we doing for that gap service? How robust is that? Are there options for folks? Who's picking up the tab on that? Is that the state through the Oregon Health Plan? Is it the counties just eating the cost? I mean, that's some data and feedback. I don't know if you have that today, but something for your work group to look at. I would like to know what's happening out there, boots on the ground, because I have veterans who, for whatever reason, they read my name in the newspaper or are talking about veterans issues, who send me text messages that, you know, I mean, Cameron, you and I've had those conversations. I get, you know, random texts from people going, hey, I saw your name, how do I get help? You know, and so it'd be good for us to know how we direct people in our own counties. I mean, I think Clackamas has great resources, but I think it's important to know what those other gaps are and how do we close those gaps. I mean, if someone's got an abscess tooth today and they're somewhere in limbo with their claim with the VA and they don't have the health care access, you know, where do we want to be channeling these people? Who's picking up the tab for that? And where are those, you know, those services in communities? I know that particularly in rural communities, when we lived in a rural community, our doctor stopped taking TRICARE because the reimbursements were so low. You know, and our doctor at the time is now serving in the other chamber, and it was just not good for his practice to do that anymore. So that's kind of the data and feedback I would like to be seeing out of that, so that we can make some assessments here, possibly legislatively, saying, we have to address those gaps. What does that look like? And how do we, you know, supplement what's going on at the VA? I know there's a lot of, you know, thought that, well, it's a federal problem because, you know, the federal government made those promises and it shouldn't be a state issue. But the reality is those people who are waiting for those services are Oregonians. They're not, you know, they don't belong to the federal government. They belong to the state of Oregon. And so where can we fill those gaps?
Chair Fagan, Representative Parrish, members of the committee, couldn't agree more. And I would say we are paying for it, but it is in terms of state and county back-end safety net services. But what we do not do well within the veterans world and also across all of state government is on that larger data piece. Who are the clients that are currently being served by the Department of Human Services, by the Department of Corrections, by the other safety net services across our system and at the local level that we could be redirecting? So out of the last, I think out of 2013 session, building that bridge to DMV and DHS and some and BOLI and some of the other agencies, with that no wrong door approach, as a veteran or a military family approaches another state agency, being able to voluntarily refer, if they, you know, asking the question if you or a loved one served in the military, and then referring that client over to us and then linking that to the local CVSO level to see if we can move the needle from 3 in 10 Oregon veterans accessing their benefits to 4 to 5 in 10 veterans. Huge amount of federal money that we could pull down. And from a gut level, we know huge amount of money at the state and county level that we could save on our own programs. But we don't have either on the IT side or on the privacy side, the clear ability just to share that data of who are our agency serving, that we could serve differently, more proactively, more with that
upfront preventative dollars that would save vast amounts on the back end.
Can I follow up?
Sure.
I was frustrated when an email chain went around, and I think you might have been on it. I know some folks from the county were on it, came through maybe a couple months ago, and it was with regard to Cover Oregon, and where people, the email basically said, you know, we should be registering our veterans through Cover Oregon, and which was its own problematic issue in and of itself. But what struck me was is that, you know, one, no, we should be getting them through the, you know, through ODVA. Obviously, again, that gap, maybe Cover Oregon is a place for, you know, the insurance exchanges or whatever that's going to look like in the future to cover that gap while they're waiting. But the reality is it was clear that the Cover Oregon piece was not talking to ODVA. So we're doing no wrong door with DHS. We're doing it with DMV and a couple other agencies. Do we need to come back in 2015 and do something universally and stop going kind of onesie-twosie, you know, having this direction and just give the direction to all agencies that this should be something that we're doing? Because clearly Cover Oregon did not have the permission to, you know, share that data, and yet there was a push from folks at Cover Oregon saying we should get our veterans to come through us to backfill that numbers and try to, you know, inflate the insurance, which, you know, kind of set me free a little bit when I read the email. So what are your thoughts on something?
Chair Fagan, Representative Parrish, members of the committee, I think it's a two-way street. We have broad authority from previous task forces that really emphasize that no wrong door, partner with ODVA and the military department, and get those referrals going. But it is a two-way street. We have found on our own end at ODVA that we are that resident expert on military and veterans affairs, but that crosses education, employment, housing, healthcare, mental health, employment, and we are truly not that expert in all of those different fields. And we've identified the two major buckets. I don't think we can ever be that expert and have that staff fully at ODVA. We have to rely on our partners. But from our end, we do see a need in that health and wellness bucket and in the education and economic opportunity bucket that we have more of that expertise on our staff so that we can be in the right meetings. So when Cover Oregon's developing their website, that front question is being flagged by us, have you or a loved one served in the military, not asked kind of well down within the website structure. We have, you know, our best partnerships are where there are that military veterans expertise on the other side, whether employment department, through Department of Labor dollars, they have a disabled veterans outreach program, the local veterans employment reps, the leavers. We have some good systems, but it needs to be a two-way street where we are in the right meetings on an ongoing basis, not just me dropping in once a year to the mental health providers and giving a high-level pitch, that we are deeply embedded in the work, and we think really across those health and wellness buckets and then the education economic opportunity. Combined with what we do on benefits, our core expertise with the counties, those two areas are going to be able to be the most powerful, we think, to drive that conversation.
I'll just give a real quick clarification.
Well, colleagues, just to give you an update, so we were asked to be done by 9 so that people can go to the CVSO summit. So we still have 2 more panels to hear in about 13 minutes, and Representative Esquivel is in the queue. So is it something that can be maybe offline?
Sure.
Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The key, I feel, to veterans on their health is, first of all, you have dedicated funding from the federal source instead of discretionary funding, because the veterans should never be used as a political ping pong ball. The second thing is, if I live in Lakeview and I have a heart problem, I may not have time to go to Portland. So therefore, we need to infuse some funding for local care. The last thing is that it's taking such an incredibly long time, and also there's still things we learn. We just learned, Cameron and I just learned that an SEL 600 and what it does, considering a DD-214. Now, these people were automatically rejected, this person, because they had an SEL 600, which, according to the source, was nothing more than a a reserve, which was not true because this was a World War II veteran that served 13 months and he was in the on the high seas in the U.S. Navy, but he was a reserve, but he served enough time. But they automatically, since he didn't get a DD-214, said an SEL 600 doesn't count. Well, we found that to be not true. So the last thing I think that we have to get our Congress's mind on is this is going to be a lot more expensive in the future the longer you have this war going on in Afghanistan. It's a war of attrition, and everyone that comes home, I mean everyone that comes home, has some sort of a depth of PTSD. So we're going to have to deal with that. And I don't think we've fully addressed that yet. So.
Thank you, Representative. And thank you, panel, very much. So we have two updates left, and I'm actually going to call you both up together because we've got about 10 minutes. So update on the SERV project from Michelle Matthews and an update from the Task Force on Implementation of the Oregon Resilience Plan from Dr. Scott Ashford.
Good morning, Chair Fagan, members of the committee. Michelle Matthews, Project Military Coordinator for the SERV project. You might remember me from my talk here in January. Very quickly, I am not going to go through the PowerPoint. We are a $5 million grant given to us by the DOD, and it is a grant around teaching supervisors supportive behaviors in order to increase job retention among the veteran population here in Oregon. Now, when I was here last time, we talked about what it did, the outcomes of it, and where we were headed. We have just finished our first burst. We're getting some really good data coming back from the organizations that were in that. You can see from the slide up there that we've gotten a lot of great involvement, particularly amongst Multnomah County, Clackamas County. We're also in talks with Oregon City. We're close to getting to an agreement with them so that they will be giving this training to their supervisors. We're working with DAS. So we're really expanding. What we are still struggling with, however, is getting out to these rural areas. And I know some of you are in these rural areas. We want to get to Lane County, Deschutes County, Tillamook. I am in talks right now with the commissioner from the Dalles. So that is good. I'll be going to a meeting with them in the second week of June. But I am really imploring you at this point, to, if you have any contacts, whether it be with the Chamber of Commerce or any commissioners, we would really appreciate your endorsement and sharing this information that we're giving to you today and that we've given to you electronically as well to these people. We really believe that this is going to put a feather in the cap of the state of Oregon, and it is the only study of its kind. So we are looking for great things to come of this. As you know, the unemployment rate among veterans, particularly from the group of 18 to 24, is twice the normal Oregon unemployment rate. So when these young men and women that come back from these deployments go to get jobs, we want them to keep them.
Right.
So with that, since we are turning and burning this morning, if you have any questions, I'd be happy to have those. But otherwise, our contact information is on the brochures. I really encourage you to contact me with any contacts that you might have to further this project. Thank you.
Any quick questions or comments from the panel? Thank you for your work. And are you the only one to speak on SERV?
This is Dr. Krista Brockwood.
Okay.
She is the project manager. Did you want to say something, Krista?
I have been working exclusively with state agencies. In fact, I have an appointment over at OHA later this afternoon. And I just want to thank the state for their support of this project. So you'll be hearing more about it. So thank you.
Thank you very much. And then finally, Dr. Scott Ashford, update on the Task Force on Implementation of the Oregon Resilience Plan.
Thank you, Chair Fagan and members of the committee. I'm Scott Ashford. I'm Dean of Engineering at Oregon State University, and I'm also chair of our Governor's Task Force on Implementing the Oregon Resilience Plan, which is preparing us for this next big earthquake on the Cascadia subduction zone. I just really have four quick points I think I'd like to update with you today. The first is that we will be recommending some sort of long-term resilience oversight so that we don't have to keep having one-year task forces. I think secondly, I just want you to know that we have reached out to a variety, and we've received very useful information from a number of state agencies beyond those that are on the task force. It includes DOGAMI, it includes Land Conservation and Development, Oregon Department of Education, as well as Oregon Business Development. And that has been very useful for us on the task force. We have written a letter to Superintendent Saxton with a request that he fill us in on how the Oregon Department of Education is approaching the seismic issue for the state schools. And in October, when our task force is complete, we will be submitting a short list of recommendations, narrowing it down from the nearly 150 that were in the Oregon Resilience Plan. And these are really going to be what we think are the important next steps that need to be taken right away to start moving us in the direction of resilience. Thank you for your time, and I appreciate any questions if you have any.
Great. Well, colleagues, we do have about 5 minutes, so yes.
It'll be short, and it's just to, you know, throw out the goodwill and kudos to, in the usual suspects in the back there, too, are part of this. But everybody's done a fabulous job. Dr. Ashford's been an excellent leader, and I have to keep saying it from its inception, House Resolution 3, I think, HCR 3, the resilience plan, I had no idea how big this would be. And how complicated it can be. So our job is to keep providing outreach, information, education, and these guys are doing a great job of making this possible for us. So thank you again and again. All Dr. Rizzo in the back, quietly doing her extremely good work.
Thank you, Representative Boone. Any other questions or comments? Great. Well, thank you very much for your work. And is there anything else on the panel? Okay, well, I am going to close the House Interim Committee on Veteran Services and Emergency Preparedness.